Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger. For the ones who get it done.
Okay, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have two very special guests. I have a co-host, Sean McCann of the Wake the Dead podcast. But my guest is S. William Snyder. He's been on my show a number of times, but he's just published a book. I read through and finished it today. Full title is The Minotaur, a Kubrick Odyssey.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
And you can see the cover of it if you're watching this on YouTube, X, or Rockfin. And you can see the other shows that I've done with Steve Snyder, or aka Recluse. We did a show on the Smiley Face Killers. We also covered his book, A Special Relationship, Trump, Epstein, and the History of the Anglo-American Establishment, which he mentions in this book. And also The Art, The Secret History of Psy War, Conspiratainment, and the Shattering of Reality. And then I think his first book or our first interview was Strange Tales of the Parapolitical.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Saving money on exterior wall lights now at Menards. Find your style with Patriot Lighting. Exterior lights enhance the look of your home. Choose from over 50 options from Patriot Lighting. Now through May 19th, get $10 instant savings on a single qualifying purchase of $100 or more on in-stock outdoor wall lights. Check out our entire selection of outdoor lights and see the rest of our deals happening now on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
And so I think this is his fourth or fifth book. And we were just on Tinfoil Hat together. I was pleasantly surprised to see him with Sam Tripoli. So we talked about these kind of recent Smiley Face Killers cases. And I think I also did a show that's also in your kind of exclusive shows on the farm about the West Memphis.
Nine Angles, I think, too.
Oh, was it Oral Nine Angles? Okay, it was one of those. But again, we're going to talk about the Minotaur Kubrick. I invited Sean on because of his knowledge of Kubrick, and we've done that 4 hours of shows on just Eyes Wide Shut. There's so much information there, but I'm glad to have Stephen back on the show. So, Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, William.
For people who may not have heard our earlier discussions about your books, maybe you can kind of talk about, I know you mentioned how important or influential Kubrick was to you. Perhaps you can talk about your background and what led up to the writing of this book, The Minotaur.
Really, it was just being a lifelong fan of Kubrick. I think going all the way back to the 90s when I was in high school, this was around the time when I first started to become serious about filmmaking. And he was one of the two directors that had really jumped out to me, along with David Lynch. And these are sort of the two that I've always used as my barometer, if you will, for all other filmmakers ever since. I mean, I tend to put them in a level entirely separate of other directors by and large. But then again, for those of you who are not familiar with me, I've been doing this stuff now for about 15 years. I started out with the Visa blog around 2010, which originally actually kind of began as a paranormal research thing and then kind of grew into this parapolemical behemoth. Got into podcasting around 2020. This was also around the time I released my first book with Frank Zero. And then I've just basically been doing the podcasting, the book thing ever since then. And this was a really exciting project for me because I have been compiling a lot of stuff for years now. And it's the first time I've really gotten a chance to share a lot of this stuff outside of some of the writings I've done on Dr. Strangelove with the public at large.
Right. And so this is kind of an intro, and you kind of dismiss some of the kind of commonly held notions. You really address the moon landing right off the bat and Kubrick's supposed connection in some way. With the filming of that, which is interesting. Your timing is interesting about this book because I just saw Bart Sibrel on Joe Rogan talking about the moon landing hoax. I like the biggest show in the world, really. And but maybe that's a good place to start. Can you talk about all the talk, the parapolitical talk or conspiracy talk about Kubrick and the moon?
Yeah, well, first I was trying to figure out where it originally went back to. The general consensus was that it had happened sometime in the 90s, but I found out as time went on that the linkage of Kubrick to the moon landing went all the way back to the 1970s. And it actually was tied into the guy who wrote the first book on the moon landing potentially being staged. I think it was like Bill Casing or something like that. I can't remember off the top of my head. But he later went on Mae Brussels' show. And then for those of you unfamiliar with Mae Brussels, she was conspiracy titan, to put it mildly. She had one of the earliest radio shows that really covered a lot of this stuff. And she was very close to an individual named Paul Krasner, who kind of plays into this a little bit, which we'll get to. But anyway, Kasing had never explicitly stated that Kubrick had staged the moon landing. He simply believed that 2001 had been used as a means to gather the filmmaking expertise that would be necessary for staging the moon landing. And his book got a fair amount of traction back to the day for many years. It was one of the most popular works on this. And he also went on Mae Brussels' show several times to promote it as well, and did talk at length about Kubrick's possible role in the moon landing potentially being staged during those encounters. So that was essentially the genesis of it. And I think it was only going into the 90s, like in some of the early Usenet groups, that people started to actually say that Kubrick was the one who had personally staged the moon landing, as opposed to simply being used to gather the technology for it. So the more I had always been a bit dubious of this to begin with, and the more I had looked at it, it became problematic for a really obvious reason that nobody seems to have considered. And that's really just basically the question of when Kubrick would have staged the moon landing. Again, assuming that he didn't film this like he did every other movie that he did, in the sense that it went on for months, sometimes years of filming, probably would have been a bit more of a faster trajectory. But even then, this isn't something that he could have just thrown together in a couple of long weekends. I mean, the special effects for this would have been very time consuming, all this other stuff. So Kubrick, like any public figure who was aware of his importance, left voluminous amounts of materials documenting his movements. And there's been several books written on the filmmaking of 2001 that have almost conclusively shown what Kubrick was doing almost every single day of this production. And then in the aftermath of 2001, after the movie was released, but before the moon landing, this is kind of another time frame that's put forward. But once again, this is when Kubrick was really knee deep in his Napoleon project. He was scouting locations all over Europe. He was commanding a team of 30 Napoleonic scholars. He was gathering costumes from the Napoleonic era, muskets, all this other crap. The point being, he was extremely busy with all of this. In fact, the Napoleon Project was one of the few scripts that he actually wrote all by himself, and it was a huge script. It probably would have been a five-hour movie if he'd ever been able to make it. So once again, it kind of becomes a simple question of this is, if Kubrick did film the moon landing hoax, when would he have done it? There's really only one possible time frame, which I didn't actually get into the book because I didn't want to perpetuate this. But the only time where you could even point to where it might have been slightly possible would have been in 68, when he got back from the UK after he was doing the edits on 2001 on the ship, and right after they did the premiere. And I say this because he had a residence in Long Island, New York at the time, and this would have been in fairly close proximity to the old Paramount studio. I believe it would have been the Astoria studio. So everybody knows about Lookout Mountain, which was this Air Force base in LA where a lot of these propaganda films were thought to have been filmed. This is a popular destination for where Kubrick could have shot the moon landing hypothetically, but you don't really find a lot of records of him being in the area at the time frames when he would have needed to be to film it. So the Air Force, though, wasn't the only branch of the military that was doing this. The Army was also in on this game via the Army Signals Corps. And Kubrick knew several people that had been in the Signal Corps, including James B. Harris, who was his early production partner, along with a guy named Paul Singer, who was a high school friend and a big mentor. Both of these guys had gone to the Army Signal Corps. So the Army Signal Corps had its own studio, like Lookout Mountain, and it was in New York, and it was the Astoria Studio on Long Island. So this is the only real time, I think, where you could realistically say if Kubrick did this, he would have had the opportunity to do so. But I still feel that it's extremely unlikely that he would have been tapped for this for no other reason than his egomania, the guy absolutely wanted to take credit for everything. And I almost have wondered in some cases if he personally perpetuated the moon landing hoaxes, that he had done it because he realized that NASA had stolen his special effects. And not only did they not give him credit for it, but they didn't pay him for it. And that's another thing Kubrick was fanatical about. He wanted to be paid for everything. So he would have definitely been pissed off if he did not get his cut of the proceeds from this operation. That's another thing about him. But kind of getting into the point, though, about Kubrick possibly perpetuating this, which is something I think people really need to take seriously. Kubrick was a huge fan of The Realist, the counterculture publication that Paul Krasner launched. And Kubrick had been subscribed to this since the late 1950s. The humor of The Realist was extremely influential on him. He actually wanted Lenny Bruce, who was closely connected to The Realist, to write Dr. Strangelove originally. Instead, he got Terry Southern, who was another guy who was tied in with The Realist. So Paul Krasner is the guy who made Mae Brussels' career. He's the one who got her radio show. He's the one who platformed her. There's a very good possibility that Kubrick would have been aware of Mae Brussels for reasons we might get to later as well. So it kind of begs the question, Paul Krasner, bit of a Discordian, a yippie, probably knew Kubrick was a subscriber, especially since he started subscribing in the late 50s when he only had maybe 100 or 200 subscribers. So Krasner is a guy who liked to do jokes on people. Kubrick had a pretty twisted sense of humor as well in some cases. I think you got to consider the possibility that he did this deliberately to troll conspiracy culture.
The credits for 2001, A Space Odyssey, had NASA credited, and there's that picture with him and the other NASA scientists and Arthur C. Clarke, like walking through the.
What was his name? It was, I can't remember his last name.
Do you think that maybe there was a correspondence? Like Kubrick was constantly on the phone with people. Whether he was in this place doing this other thing, he could have been, had his mind in it. Do you think maybe that could be the case?
Well, I think just with the way Kubrick worked, he would have wanted to be much more hands-on instead of trying to direct all of this from a distance. I mean, he definitely was in contact with NASA officials throughout and even hired a few of them to work on the special effects. But conversely, this is consistent with how he approached every project that he worked on. He always hired experts and worked with relevant government agencies. It was kind of the same thing with Dr. Strangelove. He consulted with, what was it, the Institute of Strategic Studies, a lot of these other big Cold War era think tanks, probably RAND. So there's nothing, I mean, everybody kind of points to Kubrick working with the NASA officials in 2001, but that's not at all inconsistent with how he made every other movie that he made. I mean, like I said before, with the Napoleon Project, he consulted with all of these Napoleonic scholars for years. He did the same thing with historians related to Barry Lyndon. Vietnam, he consulted with all kinds of people who were involved in the conflict, who were experts on it. So he always did this sort of level of research. And in that sense, there isn't really anything necessarily shocking in the broader overture of his career about him consulting with NASA on the film to the point that it really jumps out as being nefarious if you know his career.
Yeah, right. The guy's sense. Name was Mueller. Mueller was the NASA. And they call it, I think you even mentioned in your book, I think you referenced the Gibson book on the making of 2001 that they used to call his studio in London, NASA East, right?
Yeah, it was NASA East.
But I think you're right. I think he is trolling. There's no way that he could have been involved, but he's in that nexus because Clarke was definitely involved in either the moon landing or the fake moon landing because Clarke was all over. He was doing reporting on site. He was on TV at the time, around those times of late 60s. So,
and well, I even found... there was this one comment that some NASA official that had made that was really interesting, where essentially they were sharing the technology with Kubrick for the making of 2001 because they wanted to see how it would go with the media or something to that effect, which is just like, okay, why would NASA even care about how the media perceives its technology in the first place? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, so, there's the question, really. That's why it's being faked in the first place at all. I mean,
I definitely think there is a possibility that they could have been using the production of 2001 to develop some of this technology. But again, I just, the more I looked at it, it just didn't seem like Kubrick would have been a guy that they would have had a direct role in a lot of this.
Do you think maybe he's just taking taking credit for the front screen projection, and his ego has made that so important that he's acting like they're stealing his idea, and it just boils down to them using front screen projection, and he says, "That's mine. What are you doing?" And then he does the Apollo sweater in The Shining, and so on. Right? Do you think that?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's a possibility. I mean, this is something I talked with Jason Horsley, but it was so important for Kubrick to be perceived as something other than just your average everyday filmmaker. Like, a Stanley Kubrick film wasn't just another movie. It was an event. And I think that in that sense, especially, the notion of him faking the moon landing would have added to his mystique, which is another reason why I think that this would have been very appealing to him, because it was another thing that distinguished him from his contemporaries.
That's very convincing. I would agree at this point for listening to your, I think that's a very good
Me too. Assessment. I agree with that. I think you're right. I think he was good. He was like a total egotist, known egotist, and probably wanted to put seeds of everything, whether it's in The Shining or whatever, that he, or he probably just may have known it was fake.
Well, it's like the thing with The Shining too that's just amazing is it's like you can read so many different things into this. I mean, it was almost like a thought experiment I did when I was writing this book, is I would go watch The Shining and just try to think, like, could I conceive of it as being an allegory for this or that? And like, one of the things I came up with was the murder of Frank Lloyd Wright's mistress, Taliesin East, in like the 19-teens. And I watched it and I was like, oh my God, the references are like unmistakable now that I've seen it. And then I had this moment where I'm thinking, no, I'm just insane because I'm obsessed with Frank Lloyd Wright and I'm projecting this onto it. So I asked a couple of my buddies who know a bit about like the Taliesin East incident to go back and to watch The Shining and just think about that. And they all came back to me and they're like, no, he's definitely talking about Frank Lloyd Wright in the movie. Which, again, I mean, that's to me partly why he was so brilliant, is that you could go and look at some of these movies and you could read almost anything into them. And in the case of The Shining, where I think he was really using a lot of surrealist techniques like the cut-up method, it puts you into a place where you can see it as an allegory for genocide, for faking the moon landing, for Frank Lloyd Wright, for Nazism in general, for child abuse, for so many things. And that's, you know, I don't know of another director that could really create a work of art like that, that is almost like a reflective surface mirroring back what the viewer brings into the film.
That's like the dream, like it, your own mind creates the dream. And he's using all of the things in your mind and he's stirring those up in order to create in our heads. Each individually can be subjective, you know, could be everything.
Absolutely. It's really
interesting. That's
one of the words you just met. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, like I said, that's one of the reasons why, as I kind of wrote in the book, I feel like you have to understand the influence that surrealism had on Kubrick to really appreciate his films, because he uses so many surrealist techniques to affect the viewer to subconscious level, bypassing the conscious mind. And I think that obviously a lot of other directors have attempted that. Hitchcock was very good at it. Lynch is excellent at it. But Kubrick, to my mind, was unparalleled at using a lot of these techniques.
And that's kind of what I wanted you to expand on, is the surrealism. That's kind of one aspect of Kubrick that I hadn't heard or read before. And it's not just the concept of surrealism, it's the people within the movement that he had overlapping kind of friends and acquaintances. Can you kind of expand on that?
Yeah, it was really interesting to me. I actually found out the one time that it's known that Kubrick appeared in a fictional movie was a 1947 or 48 picture called All the Dreams Money Can Buy, which was made by, I think it was Max Richter now, if I remember correctly, but surrealist filmmaker. It had several other prominent surrealist filmmakers in it. Kubrick appeared in that along with both of his future wives, actually, Tobias Metz, I think, and the second one. Oh, gosh, Ruth. God, I'm having a blank on that now. But it's really interesting because the section that he appears in, along with both of his future wives, was directed by the surrealist artist Man Ray. And Man Ray is a guy who probably had, I mean, Kubrick's acknowledged that Man Ray had an influence on him, but it was probably much more so than has been acknowledged. There's the self-portrait for Man Ray, for instance, which has like that kind of menacing stare of him doing. And there's some thought that this might have been the basis, you know, for the Kubrick crazy face, the, you know, that kind of thing. But it's another technique, I think, of surrealism that Kubrick adopted in this case, probably from Man Ray. But what's significant about this is that around the time Man Ray was working on this film, he was also going in and out of Los Angeles, and he had a friend there known as George Adel, who in recent years has become a very compelling suspect for the Black Dahlia murders. Adel, actually it was his son, Steve Adel, who wrote quite an excellent book, several now at this point, going into the case for his father being the Black Dahlia killer. It's very compelling. Some of his other accounts, such as him possibly being tied in with the Zodiac, are maybe a bit more of a stretch. But Adel being the Black Dahlia killer is very possible. It's almost surely, it almost as certain that he raped his own daughter, Tamer Hodel. And that also brings us into some interesting things in Kubrick's later career, specifically related into the filming of Lolita. So the star who played the title character in Lolita, Sue Loyne, she grew up in California. She had two other really close friends growing up. One of them was Michelle Phillips, who went on to found the Mamas and the Papas. And the other one was Tamar Hodel.
Tamar Hodel, incredible.
Tamar Hodel was actually the one who, I believe, originally got Sue her copy of Lolita when she was 11 or 12 and explained the masturbation sequence to her. So these three were really close. Of course, you have all the stuff with Tamar and her father possibly being the Black Dahlia killer. If you've read Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, you know the Mamas and the Papas were just absolutely at the forefront of the Laurel Canyon scene. Papa John Phillips was a good friend of Roman Polanski. A lot of the rumors circulating around sex tapes involving celebrities in L.A. that Polanski was filming, the Phillips, Michelle, and John were both said to have been actively involved in that, along with Mama Cass. So you've got all of that craziness going on. And then getting back to Sue Loyne, she was also having an affair, supposedly voluntarily, but there's been a lot of dispute about that, with James B. Harris during the filmmaking of Lolita. And you've got to remember, she was about 16 at the time when they made this, when Harris was 39. So
this is a picture of them, by the way. I found a picture because I wanted to see what Harris looked like.
Yeah, she looks so happy, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's elated. And he kind of, yeah, I mean, there's a 20-year difference or something like that. But this guy was an important figure in Kubrick's life. He was one of his early collaborators. That's James B. Harris.
Yeah, no, he produced The Killing with Kubrick along with Lolita, helped him set up Dr. Strangelove. He was very important in Kubrick's early career. So it's just fascinating that you see how the scene with George Adel sort of bleeds into what was going on in L.A. with the sort of Laurel Canyon scene, if you will, that Dave McGowan has been talking about. And then on top of that, you have Kubrick kind of the periphery of this. He knew some of the filmmakers who were tied in to What Dreams Money Can Buy. He appeared in it. I haven't been able to confirm decisively if George Adel had seen the movie, but I think that it's all but certain that he would have. Kubrick was highly influenced by Man Ray. And then later he's selecting an actress to star in Lolita, who was a good childhood friend of Tamar Hodel's, or excuse me, Tamar Hodel was a good friend of hers during her childhood. So there's just a lot of strange stuff with that, and this sort of broader scene that intersects with Kubrick. Of course, on top of that, Kubrick was also a good and longtime friend of Roman Polanski. So that's another thing. I mean, besides what people tend to talk about with Polanski, with the potential sex tapes that turned up in the Manson investigation, you also have to take into account that he was a good friend of Hugh Hefner's during this time frame, i.e. the late 60s, the early 70s. if you've seen Secrets of the Playboy, Secrets of Playboy, it's pretty evident that Hefner was essentially running an Epstein-style blackmail operation out of the Playboy Mansion and the Playboy Clubs. So Polanski's a regular in all of this. Hefner ends up funding his adaptation of Macbeth in 1971. Kubrick is a good friend of his. Kubrick's, Polanski, that is to say, Kubrick's cousin, Paul Perveler, who ended up becoming convicted of murder in 69, was an ex-cop who actually did some security work for the Playboy Club. So there's a lot of weird intersection with this.
Hodel was doing underground abortions, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's how he knew medically how to cut up the woman who was the victim of the...
Yeah, he was a trained doctor. Right. And then another weird thing, too, with Kubrick's cousin related to the Black Dahlia is the cop, one of the cops who investigated the murders that Prevailer was convicted of was John St. John, or Jigsaw John, famous LAPD detective. He tracked a lot of serial killers, including the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, I think the Hillside Strangler. But detective on the Black Dahlia case. He got the Black Dahlia case, I think, in like 1950, shortly after he became a detective, and he was the lead detective on the case until he retired in 1993. And supposedly, he was also David Lynch's source for Lost Highway, which is extremely influential. Kubrick's cousin, the cop who gets his arrest partially, is the Black Dahlia cop. The prosecutor for Kubrick's cousin is Vincent Bugliosi. This is the major case he does right before the Manson case, literally right before the Manson case. And then the defense attorney for Prevailer's mistress on this case is Melvin Belli, right. Jack Ruby's attorney, and the guy who would later get a letter from the Zodiac in 69. So okay,
yeah, you can't write this stuff.
Yeah,
Belli's like
with Ruby Black Dahlia detective, yeah. Bugliosi, and Belli, Jack Ruby's attorney, all involved in this trial with Paul Prevailer.
Yeah, I mean, he had to have known. Like, my understanding is that Kubrick was on the phone with his parents and his sister or something all the time. Like, he still kept in close contact.
No, he was very close to his family, and that's where the stuff with Prevailer gets really interesting, because there was some speculation that Prevailer might have tried to kill his father, Kubrick's uncle, because his father was shot in the face in Mexico when he was coming back from a vacation that Prevailer had gotten for his parents for their anniversary. And then on top of that, Bugliosi writes about this in the book that he wrote on Prevailer. It's Till Death Us Do Part, I think. But he mentions that Prevailer had tried to get two local hoods to kill a relative that was coming to visit in LA with $70,000 in cash on them. So this could have been Kubrick's other uncle, Melvin Prevailer, who funded his first movie, Fear and Desire. He was quite a wealthy pharmacist in the Southern California area, but it could have been Kubrick's parents too, because this is right around the time that they were moving to LA in the late 1960s. If they were, say, maybe trying to buy a house, well, then you can understand why maybe they had $70,000 in cash with them. So if he tried to kill Kubrick's parents, you damn well better believe Kubrick would have made sure that he spent the rest of his life in prison.
Do you think that this is the underground that informed him that eventually became Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah. I mean, I think that this was part of the underground. I think that he potentially also saw things in Long Island as well. I mean, again, I don't think it's a coincidence that the Somerton Mansion in Eyes Wide Shut is set in Long Island. It's, what is it, Glen Cove, I think, is where it was located. But this is another thing that I got into in the book that kind of brings to mind the whole Monica Haller. And is it Haller or Holler? She was the chick who was whipped and filmed and potentially raped at Roy Radin's estate on Long Island. I think it was in the Hamptons, Hampshire, or something like that. The Hamptons, that's right. But this was a part of like a broader S&M scene that was going on at the time that involved a lot of these wealthy elites. And at the forefront of it was a private detective called Thomas Corbelly. Corbelly was tied in with the Profumo affair in the UK. He was a very good friend of Roy Cohn. In fact, he did a lot of detective work for Roy Cohn over the years. And then Corbelly would later turn up in the Heidi Fleiss sex ring in LA in the late 80s, early 90s as well. So this guy was basically at the forefront of a lot of these elite sex circles.
Wasn't Corbelly friends with Ward, Stephen Ward?
Like yeah. He knew Stephen Ward. Yeah.
I did a show on that so people can look through my archives. It's Douglas was the author, and it's about Stephen Ward.
And his female situation. His roommate in the UK during Profumo was William Mellon Hitchcock, the big LSD baron who became the financier for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love as well. So anyway, Corbelly, after Profumo, he ends up going to Long Island. He brings this weird S&M scene that he learned in the UK, probably in the rings connected to Ward, to Long Island, where they start having like the whipping tree and engaging in this, I guess, the metaphysics of the whip, if you will, where it's used as a form of consciousness raising or some such shit. So yeah, it does kind of make you wonder if Kubrick was hearing rumors about that. I mean, certainly this stuff was unfolding at these, you know, isolated mansions like you see in Eyes Wide Shut. I mean, certainly if you go look at Roy Radin's estate, was it Ocean Castle, I think, it does bear a bit of a passing resemblance to Somerton. So
Douglas wrote that Ward was into black magic, so he had all the black magic stuff going on, and that he lived at a cottage behind somebody's estate, and the owners had to
get Lord Astor,
right? And the owners, like, once they passed away,
they had an exorcist perform,
and said it was the darkest energy they had ever felt or something. So that kind of stuff ties kind of into the Eyes Wide Shut ritual scene, right?
Well, Michael Benintine, I believe, he was a comedian and an actor. He was a really good friend of Peter Sellers, actually. They were part of the Goon Squad back in the day. But he actually alleged that Ward was running a modern-day Hellfire Club in the UK. Now, I haven't found anything else to confirm that, but there definitely were instances of cultism and some of these orgies that Ward was turning up at, along with a lot of S&M and some other, you know, kind of Story of O-esque type of trappings.
Right. And I think my understanding is that he lived close to the Hellfire Clubs up the kind of Thames.
Well, none of that stuff is very far from the UK. I mean, it's within like 30 or something miles of each other. But yeah. I mean, it wasn't super far from that.
That kind of activity is like the end result of psychopathy. Like, where you find psychopathy, there you will find S&M domination of others with the whatever, the Society of the Whip or whatever the hell that, like, I think they go hand in hand. I'm actually going to be speaking with John Euler, a doctor, but we're going to be talking about how porn relates to that. It's like it's a mirror at the level of psychopathy. And, when people go that far, I think it's just the inevitable where it ends up. So whether it has a name like Hellfire Club or whatever it may be, like, there's always someone somewhere at that level of psychopathy, I think. You know, it's not like Hellfire Club's just decided to stop happening. You know, people are still psychos out there. Anyway, just quick note. Sorry.
Oh, you're fine, man. It's like my spirit animal once said, when you can't get it up anymore, that's when shit starts getting weird. And I kind of think that's, you know, what happens in a lot of these circles with these influential people. I mean, you know, you can get all the women, all the boys, whatever you want. And after a while, right, it just doesn't have the thrill that it once did. So that's when you start getting into the really weird stuff.
Right. And I don't think it's
heard that same thing in professional sports. Like, they get kinked out, like, they get so bored of just normal heterosexual relations. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, even
transsexuals and stuff.
I mean, if you look, watch Secrets of the Playboy, I mean, they even get into how Hugh Hefner, I mean, it probably started to dabble in homosexuality and a lot of weird S&M stuff.
You know, bestiality.
Again, yeah, bestiality. But again, it's the same thing, you know, when you're having those sort of insane lifestyles. I mean, the thrill starts to dissipate after a while, so you're going to be chasing erotic asphyxiation. Yep, right. There you go, Nagliowski.
Yeah, I think you mentioned her in the book, right?
Yeah, I mentioned her in the book, and I just talked about her in the smiley face show that we did.
Yeah, the tinfoil hat episode, I heard
that. Yeah, I mean, she's another one where, again, you know, you just see this really weird S&M stuff where essentially you're having this autoerotic asphyxiation, this sort of simulated hanging where the male members are literally brought to the brink of death and then they're revived by sexual stimulation.
Well, think about it, though. Really, it's not like a sex thing at that point. It's a submission and dominance thing. Like, you submit your whole life to this woman who's killing you, you know.
I think that's why this stuff was so big in the UK.
Right.
It's like, you know, I mean, after centuries of these aristocrats, you know, ruling over the world and so forth, it just seems like they really got big into the S&M thing. It just sort of manifested in this sense of like, you either need to take absolute power over an individual to one extreme, or conversely, you went in the polar opposite direction. You had to become totally submissive in your private life or something like that. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's very much so.
It's weird, like a predator prey type thing. Like, I mean, Kubrick almost was showing us with the apes in 2001, like, you know, the when they become predators, when they evolve, like, as if that's what should be held up as the highest. I'm trying to bring it back to Kubrick here. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. No worries. But I mean, that's really fitting. And it's a point that he makes in multiple films. I mean, of course, in 2001, he later sort of mirrors the, you know, the waterhole confrontation between the two rival gangs and the space station between the U.S. and the Soviet faction. He kind of does that as well in A Clockwork Orange, where, again, you know, you see the two rival gangs sort of meeting up and vying for control, in this case over a woman as opposed to a watering hole. But yeah, it's kind of like, like, no matter the environment that humanity finds itself in, there's always those baser passions that are dragging us down, if you will.
Right, right.
And I mean, I certainly think that Kubrick would have seen a lot of that in the circles that he traveled in.
Yeah, I think that's what Barry Lyndon was telling us, like how disgusting these aristocrats are, you know, and how empty they are inside. Like, I still like to think that Kubrick maintained his humanity through all of these encounters with the Hollywood types and these moneyed professionals. Like, what do you think? Do you think he had his morality intact at the end?
Yeah, I do, though. I do think that Kubrick struggled with a lot of darkness throughout his life. And I think it's really illustrative when you look at a character like Carol Quigley in Lolita versus Jack Torrance in The Shining, because I do believe that The Shining, at least my personal interpretation, it's an allegory for child abuse. I do believe that Jack was sexually abusing Danny. And it's interesting in this context when you go back and look at Quilty from Lolita, who was the character that Peter Sellers played in that. He's sort of Humbert Humbert's rival pedophile. He's a filmmaker, a playwright. He's a very davenir, dashing individual. And despite the fact that he is an utterly appalling human being, the audience almost feels a odd sympathy for him because he is such a magnetic personality. I mean, it's this kind of chic, sexy character here. So this is, I feel, in some ways almost a reflection of where Kubrick was at around 1960, just at the time that he was becoming a parent. But I do believe that becoming a parent fundamentally changed him. And by the time you get to The Shining, it's like the polar opposite with Jack. Jack is a pathetic bigot. He's a failed novelist. He's probably a terrible writer. He can't take care of his family. He's just essentially, I think, in a lot of ways, everything Kubrick despises. In a sense, I think you could almost read The Shining as a sort of exorcism on Kubrick's part, in that he's almost trying to finally release all of this darkness that was haunting his soul into this picture in a way.
Wow, that's really well said. I like that.
One of the interesting things that you write and what he identifies with is Bill Harford. I think that was an interesting insight, is that that may be Kubrick, right? It's not just the everyman, but it's actually Stanley going through. And I think you back it up by showing this is the 50s New York. This isn't the modern 1999 New York, right? It's the part of his youth, and he's going through this homage of his background and his pictures and his life stuff.
Like the newsstand picture.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, there with Emilio in the newsstand. Mm-hmm. As he's being chased, like, that is an homage to when the 50s, when he took the picture, and like FDR is dead. I think that was
Yeah.
It's D'Alessandro, right? The guy who was his driver.
Yeah.
Which you mentioned in this book, too. Yeah.
Right.
But it is interesting. So it shows that he's really not part of that aristocracy. And that might be part of his background, also his Jewishness. Like, he's acknowledging it, but not acknowledging it. Like, it seems
I mean, I think in the case of both Bill Harford and Barry Lyndon, I definitely think that those are the two most autobiographical characters that Kubrick ever had in his pictures. And in both cases, they're essentially ambitious social climbers who manage to get into the periphery of the aristocracy and subsequently find out that they're in over their heads effectively. In a lot of cases, because fundamentally they still in their hearts are decent people. I mean, this is very much, I think, Barry's downfall, because he enters into a world where he essentially has to become a kind of scoundrel to thrive in it. He becomes a spy, a mercenary, all this other stuff. But at the end, when he's in this duel with his stepson, his stepson's pistol misfires. He could have killed him right there. He's an expert shot, but he throws his shot and gives his stepson, who despises him, another crack at it and ends up losing his leg, and it leads to his downfall. But I think that that is Kubrick's reflection on himself, how despite operating in this world, he still maintained a certain decency to his spirit, if you will, which is totally void in the aristocracy there. I mean, they're just depicted as the most petty, crass people that you could possibly imagine. And I think that you see that kind of continuing on with Eyes Wide Shut as well, in the case of the Harford character, where again, this is a guy who, despite all of his failings, is a fundamentally decent man, which I think is ultimately his downfall when trying to intersect in these circles, or interact rather in these circles.
Right. He folded immediately and he told Alice everything, even though Gold Mask guy was like, if you say a single word, he goes home and immediately tells her, you know, because he feel it, like he emoted it, like, oh, he sees the mask and boom. And it's the same thing with the other, when Barry Lyndon became rich and he had everything he wanted, he was sitting there empty, like you could see how unhappy he was, because he's not getting any real stimulation of anything really good. He's just got all the opulence. Whereas the people that are total psychopaths, they'd be perfectly happy. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be feeling bad or forlorn for whatever life they could have had or whatever. You know, they'd start banging whores or whatever else they do, doing drugs and all this, you know, like enjoying, in quotes, their lives, when really it's total emptiness. And that's where we see that Barry tries to put himself in there. He thinks that's what happiness is. And when he gets there, he's like, empty.
Well, it's,
yeah.
Go ahead. Well, it's interesting too, because the only real happiness that he does find in that world is becoming a father, which isn't something that he even needed to enter into the aristocracy to be.
Right.
That's kind of another thing that makes it so tragic, in that it's the way that he spoils his son that ultimately leads to his premature death. And I think in some ways you could maybe draw parallels with Harford as well. I mean, ultimately it seems like he finds true happiness in the family units, which I think is why he ultimately decides to blind himself in trying to maintain the family unit, if you will, as opposed to trying to confront the evils within the world, because that's where, you know, his refuge is.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, because he doesn't know the name of the babysitter.
That's a good
point. He doesn't know he doesn't really, he's not thinking about, like, you know, the wife calls when he's with the hooker. He's like, you know, she says, I'm not taking track of time, but guess who is, like, you know, and she calls up and says, hey, when are you coming home? Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, whoops. Sorry. I forgot about you. You know, I don't know if his refuge is really that. I think he believes it to be. He sees himself like that is what it's supposed to be. But then inside, like, you know, another thing, like, funny thing that Kubrick wanted to cast Steve Martin as Bill Harford.
Yeah.
And one of Kubrick's favorite movies was The Jerk. Mm-hmm. And I connect those. I think, like, maybe, I mean, if it goes with what you're saying, maybe he's being self-deprecating and saying that he's been the jerk for whatever, being, you know, falling for his own desires or whatnot. But that it seems like Bill is a stumbling fool who is just like just doing what he thinks he has to, like goes to medical school, like, you know, always a doctor, you know, like it's just that's the path you take, you know, and he's just doing the thing. He's not really thinking, not aware, just, you know, useless, you know, I don't know. What do you think about that?
No, I definitely see what you're saying. And I mean, I do think that that's a good point in the sense that Bill's kind of a guy who's been sleepwalking through his life. And I think that that is where, you know, he's able to be induced somewhat into the series of events that unfold. But I mean,
that's how they control him. That's
exactly. Because I mean, there was a certain longing there, but I think at the end, sort of like Kubrick himself, he was able to turn away from it because he did realize that there was a darkness to this world that he was kind of given a glimpse of, if you will. But you know, and it's kind of interesting in that sense too, like you were talking about. Actually, before he had considered Steve Martin, he had actually considered Woody Allen for the film. Like, a lot of people don't realize this, but Eyes Wide Shut was supposed to be a comedy for, like, years and years. And you can still see, like, elements of the comedic aspects to it.
Yeah, it's weird they made Lolita a comedy. You know, how do they do that? You know, like, it's weird they even made a movie about it. Like, it's very...
Well, especially in that era, in, like, 1960 or something, it still kind of boggles the mind in hindsight that they were actually able to get away with doing that in, like, 1960.
Totally. But who was running the Hollywood is a bunch of pedophiles. We all know that now. So, of course, they were like, oh, yeah, do the pedophilia one, sure. That's good.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
See if they'll let it pass. Like, see if they'll pay for it. Like,
yeah, I mean, I do think in some ways, too, I mean, it was essentially a kind of an attempt to see where the public temperature was, if you will, in terms of like releasing a picture like that. But I think that's kind of why, I mean, it had to be done as more of a comedy as well. It sort of was a way to take, I think, the edge off a little bit of the film.
Yeah, good point. Good point. And it was but it was like the rivalry of the pedophiles. There was like the confident artistic one who's got like the witch for a wife. And, you know, all the town loves. And then the other guy is like submissive to a 13-year-old girl, does her toenails. Like, it's really he's showing the minds of these people and how like the range of the pedophile. And in the end, the guy who's submissive becomes brave and kills the other one, you know,
well, I think that's...
for his love of this, you know, it's weird.
Well, I think it is a weird thing, but I mean, I do think that you can infer that like Humford actually did love Lolita in those final, well, I guess you could say the beginning and also the end of the film, because I mean, he's able to A, realize that he's a monster, and then B, he's able to do probably the one redeeming thing that he's ever done in his life, and that's kill Quilty, who's an even more unrepentant monster than he is. So it's kind of like that's the one thing with Humbert. He does find redemption in that, and that he's able to recognize his own wickedness and destroy it in another predator.
Do you think that the Quilty hiding behind the portrait and then being shot through the portrait, do you think that relates to the portraits in the billiard room at the end of Eyes Wide Shut?
I hadn't thought about that, but that's an interesting point. I mean, I think you could maybe see that as well as maybe a commentary on Hollywood itself. Like you always have, you know, these predators that are hiding behind the pictures and this sort of glamorous image. I mean, of course, you know, he's got this painting of this beautiful woman, you know, that he's trying to use up his shield, and it's this monstrous creature lurking behind it. I think in a sense, that's about as good of a metaphor for Hollywood as you could come up with in a lot of ways.
If you look at that picture, the framing, the painting that he hides behind is sitting atop a tiger skin rug. And the tiger is that. Like, so that's the Lady Babylon. It's the
beast. It's interesting.
Yeah. The Scarlet Whore.
It's an even more fitting one with Hollywood, too.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, again, that goes back to D.W. Griffith and his own attempts to create Babylon in Hollywood. So, yeah, I mean, that connection has always been there.
Wow. Didn't they have the tiger too in the final scene of Eyes Wide Shut?
They did.
I believe they did.
The stuffed tigers are hanging right when she walks to the old guys at the end of the hallway.
Yeah, but also like the background is the same color as Crowley's Toth tarot card.
Oh, go right.
Deck. So he has that. I mean, it's incredible. He has almost the same thing of the phallus entering the circle. Like, it's totally crazy. Like, how he got that so right. It's just off the charts.
The lust card is the one with the woman on the tiger with the seven-headed beast. And then there was the other one. You're talking about the devil card where it's
got the devil goat card. It's the same color as the room. Right.
It's got the testicles.
Let me see if I can find it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that red is like a theme. It goes through the whole movie. It ties it all those pieces right together. It's really interesting photographically how he does that. And then the red billiard table.
Yeah.
You know, and room 237 relates that. But then even further, if you were to think that red billiard table is the carpet in the ritual, if you look up, the portraits are the guys on the balcony. And then if you look in that portrait above the table, the guy directly behind Ziegler, the portrait, there's a dog, and the dog's looking up at the guy holding a tricorn hat.
Interesting.
Yeah. So this is all stuff that I found. Like, we gotta talk more.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things, because I was trying to look into some of the occult strains that Kubrick had been looking at with Eyes Wide Shut, and I'm sure you guys are aware. A lot of people have claimed that it was depicting a kind of Saturnine ritual, if you will, which I was able to find some pretty strong evidence for that, because one of the books that Kubrick had used for it was a work called Cult and the Occult.
Right.
And
Francis King.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It had a couple of sections in there on sex magic, but specifically the Brotherhood of Saturn was chronicled in it. And I think that this was actually one of the first times that the Brotherhood had even been addressed in the English language as well. So I definitely think that there is some merit to this potentially depicting some kind of Saturnine ritual as well.
Right. I keep thinking Inanna Ishtar because of the stars at the party, at the dance, you know, and then the Easter, the fertility rituals of the Hieros Gamos. I believe that it might be related to that. And
yeah, he mentions that, Steve mentions it in the book. And
oh, okay, good.
You guys are on the same wavelength.
That's great. And then
we're at the 50-minute mark, guys. Okay, do you have time to take some questions, Steve?
Oh, well, one other thing I just wanted to say, too, about the stars, which is interesting, which I just kind of saw. So apparently one of the inspirations for the Somerton mansion was actually Hearst Castle in San Simeon, which I just was able to tour last week when I was in California. And actually, they have those 8-pointed stars all over Hearst Castle. So I got to believe that was exactly where Cooper got that from.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Well, they put it on that castle because they're the same cult, you know, mm-hmm. the fertility. Mm-hmm. And Somerton, the summer ritual to the opening of the year of the season of life, you know, in the spring, the path of the sun, like all of those occult ideas, like it's that's where it lands. It's interesting that he put it at Christmas, though. It's well, like that's a for fertility. The Saturnalia,
though. And I mean, also, yeah. You sort of get into.
There's Candlemas and Imbolc, those other ones, too. Like, Imbolc, I think, is February 2nd.
Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, partly with the Saturnalia, the reasons, well, there were a couple of reasons why it was significant. I mean, on the one hand, you had sort of the, what was it, the King of Fools or something that you later see kind of captured in the Catholic feast of the Feast of Fools. But I think that's basically the role that Hartford is playing. He's essentially your Christmas fool here, the King of Fools, whatever right. you want to call him. Who in his journey there. So I think that's one of the reasons why he picked that. And then also because Saturnalia was so important to the Roman imperial cult, right. because essentially it was a festival for consuming and incorporating the gods of conquered nations into the Roman pantheon. That's right. essentially how Baal Amon was brought into or equated to Saturn in the Roman culture was through right. the Saturnalia festival when they actually did human sacrifices for this during the Punic War. So I think that's also a reason why he opted to do that, because it became so connected with Baal and Roman mythology in the Saturnalia festival. And this is something Kubrick would have definitely have been aware of, because he was a huge fan of James George Frazer and the Golden Bough.
Do you think, what about Cybele as well? She was celebrated during the same time of the Saturnalia and they would have the festivals where the Gali, and they would the people would go in a frenzy and castrate themselves, and the whole Attis thing. And Cybele was absorbed into Rome as Magna Mater, and that was all it all went into the same soup. I wonder if that is also, because that would relate directly to Inanna Ishtar.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a reference to that. And again, I need to emphasize, this is something that if you go to any of these big estates and visit them, it's blatantly obvious. It's clear to me that there was very much a cult of goddess worship within the founding fathers and a lot of the other prominent dynasties in this country.
Right. And isn't Columbia goddess worship?
Yeah, that's exactly. That's the syncretic version of what we created. It's Columbia. Columbia is essentially our incorporation of this deity into an American pantheon. She's right. Columbia. And you see her worshipped at these different mansions and different personifications. So if you go to like the Biltmore in Asheville, North Carolina, or Nemours in Delaware, which is a DuPont estate, there you see her as Diana, the huntress. She is constantly right. depicted as a warrior in that. But you go to Hearst Castle, you see her there, but she's always with the child. It's the mother persona. So I firmly believe that within this sort of circle of these mansions, which are effectively temples, and this is something very much I think Kubrick is implying with Eyes Wide Shut, you have different ones dedicated to the goddess and different personifications where you see right. her as the mater, the mother, the crone, the huntress, and all these other different things.
Right.
So it's really mind-blowing, but it just is incredible to me, having seen a lot of this stuff firsthand, how much of it Kubrick got right from the Venetian pews, which you kind of see a reference there. There's sort of this sea monster looking thing, which you see in Ziegler's fireplace in that one scene. Of these mansions have that creature. All of them have tapestries depicting scenes of Greco-Roman mythology, usually involving Pan and Diana or one of her other personifications. Wow. So it's just, if you've seen enough of these, it's clear that there is a religion present in a lot of these right. and that there are specific references that appear over and over again in all of these places.
Wow, and what about Kubrick's depiction of maiden, mother, and crone, or at least the life cycle of the female, by showing us Helena and then Lili Sobieski and then Domino and Mandy and Alice? Like, we see the full range of that character, you know,
yes, just
depicted by different women, but still it's the same life that they're living, just in different stages.
No, very much so. And I mean, it's kind of interesting too, that almost all of the women in this are depicted as prostitutes as well, in some form or other. Of course, right. this is pretty distinct from Trauma Nouvelle, where they're essentially aristocrats in a lot of cases. But I think that that also plays into the sort of sacred marriage, quote unquote, aspect of this as well. But yeah, I mean, you do see this sort of references to the goddess, but I think also maybe a commentary on how it's become so debased in American culture with what we're doing with some of these traditions.
Well, plus the scarlet whore, right? She accepts all, she gives to all of the, you know, all comers, I guess. And that's, you know, that relates to the Inanna, priestesses of Inanna, the young women that were donated as nuns by their families to the cult. They are forced to prostitute their body, to be prostitutes for the church. And that's where the collection plate comes from in the Roman Catholicism. Like that, the men would come and they would use the nun, and then their sins would be released with their ejaculate. And then the nun like takes the sin away from the person. They go home clean. So, like, the idea of Inanna ish, like, at all relates to whores. Like, it's all the women of Inanna are whores. So,
Which again, yeah, you definitely see reflected in Eyes Wide Shut. Because I even think Domino could potentially be a part of the cult.
Totally. I mean,
you see the weird masks and stuff that she's got in the apartment. And I mean, yes. It does. I mean, in a sense, you almost see like different stages of this grooming, if you will, with her, with, you know, the daughter of the costume, a proprietor. And then later,
right. She's not really her daughter. He's not his daughter.
Yeah, yeah. And then obviously. Even Alice possibly, and Hartford's daughter as well.
Right.
Yeah, they're all part of the cult, except Bill doesn't know it. He doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like Young Goodman Brown or something like that, where it's like the whole town, you know, is a part of the satanic cult except him.
Yeah. Except him, yeah. But then if you listen to Jay Parker or other SRA survivors, they do build a whole town for that. It happens. Like he was in Arden, Delaware. He's also talking about Rose.
Rose Valley. I've been to Rose Valley. Arden though.
See, like, I mean, so any, well, anyway, this, I mean,
but he just shows how astute he was. And I think a theme in your book, Steve, is to show the kind of incredible research that Kubrick did for all of his films, including Eyes Wide Shut, but just like the background. And you said that he might have been an intelligence asset and that's what propped him up. I'd never heard that, but it makes sense if he was compiling this information and giving it to third parties or something like that. I mean, where did you find evidence, or did you just deduce that yourself, or was there a reference or what?
Well, I mean, he definitely worked with a lot of people who had intelligence ties in the early part of his career. Like I said before, James B. Harris, essentially the child rapist of Sue Loyne. He was in the Army Signal Corps. Paul Singer, who was another good friend of Kubrick's, was in the Army Signal Corps. Got a lot of support from Kirk Douglas, who had a very close relationship to the U.S. Information Agency for a lot of years. In fact, the U.S. Information Agency is actually a recurring thread in a lot of Kubrick's early work with a lot of his collaborators and so forth. Of course, he worked with, what was it, the de Rochemont brothers, I believe, who the one brother had actually worked on making the Animal Farm adaptation that the CIA had sponsored in the 1950s.
Right, I think that was Tracy Barnes was involved with that. Yeah,
yeah, there were a lot of people. What was it? Kubrick helped cover the World Freedom Federation or something like that, which was essentially a CIA front in his early career. He actually had worked on the film project called Shark Hunt for David Atlee Phillips' brother. David Atlee Phillips is a very notorious CIA officer who's been linked to the Kennedy assassination. His brother, John Phillips, who Kubrick had worked with, I think it was John, but I might be mistaken on that. But this brother was also suspected of being involved with the intelligence community. He had been a Marine, I think, during World War II. He had ended up serving in Laos. I'm pretty sure that he was involved with the airline that became Air America eventually. And then getting into Dr. Strangelove, it seemed clear to me that Kubrick was being given information from the Kennedy administration in making the film. Because there's one line specifically, it's a comedic line that General Turgeson utters when he's discussing the prospects of a nuclear strike on the Soviet Union and the response. And he says something like, "Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but 10 to 15 million Americans dead tops." But the thing is, that's actually what Kennedy was more or less told when he talked to the military brass in a highly classified National Security Council meeting. Because going up to the release of Dr. Strangelove, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were gung-ho to launch a preemptive strike against the Soviet Union. So they had started pushing Kennedy for this going into 61, and they were hoping to carry it out by the end of 63. And during one of these National Security Council meetings, that's when Kennedy had asked, what are the civilian casualties going to be in the United States? 15 million people dead. Oh, no big deal. So you got to kind of think about this. Dr. Strangelove was originally supposed to come out in 63. In fact, it actually was supposed to premiere on November 22nd, which was the day Kennedy was assassinated.
Friday, right? Yeah.
Had Kennedy lived, it would have come right out in the midst of when the Joint Chiefs of Staff would have been pushing for this nuclear strike. So I definitely think that Kubrick was being used by the Kennedy administration to push back against the military paranoia at the time, because you can see with like the Jack D. Ripper character, I mean, that's a total parody of the John Birch Society, which in turn was really very much an organization that was established by the Pentagon to perpetuate propaganda on its behalf. So that's kind of the interesting thing with that whole I think, time frame with Kubrick in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, is you can almost see a propaganda war being waged in this time frame, on the one hand, by the Pentagon through agencies like the Institute for American Strategy and the grassroots, like the John Birch Society, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, through the U.S. Information Agency via filmmakers like Kubrick, like John Frankenheimer, because all these guys were connected with Kirk Douglas and that kind of circled filmmakers around them. So these guys are involved in Paths of Glory, Spartacus, The Manchurian Candidate, Dr. Strangelove, 7 Days in May, and Seconds, all coming out in a period of like about 6 or 7 years. All of these filmmakers are close to the Kennedy administration, to the U.S. Information Agency. So I definitely think you can see some real sparks flying, so to speak, with just the process of these movies being made. And in contrast to that, what was being perpetuated by a lot of grassroots organizations like the John Birch Society at the same time.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Look, all this stuff. I mean, Kubrick, and I think the Minotaur title for your book is accurate, an accurate description, not only of his companies, I think it was one of his early companies, but also just his knowledge of like classics and esotericism. And just, he just was so hyper knowledgeable. That's really just it. Like, I think that's another theme in your book, just how his frame of reference was vast, which makes him just an artist you can kind of and analyze in books and talks like this, because he left so many pieces in his art. It's incredible. Just something else. Is there anything, we're at the hour mark, I got to run. Is there anything you'd like to add, Steve or Sean, before we wrap it up?
Please consider buying my book.
And where can they find it?
It is available on Amazon and also too at the Farm's official store, which you can find links to over on the Patreon and all this other good stuff.
Yeah, and if you send me your links, I'll just put them right in the
show. Yeah. What was the question about the tarot?
I would love Recluse to give us his interpretation of the tarot spread on the cover, please.
Well, that's the Sola Busca deck, actually. It's like a variation on that. So one of the characters on the left is George Hedel. The one on the top, obviously, is Kennedy. The one on the bottom is Leslie Stevens, who was the creator of The Outer Limits. Kubrick is in the center, and the one on the right doesn't really have like a purpose. But Mark Adams has proposed that the Sola Busca tarot deck, which is one of the oldest known, it's from the 15th century, was possibly one of the repositories of a cult of Saturn among the aristocracy. So that was one of the reasons why I did it. And then specifically this sort of Celtic cross spread I chose, because that's actually also featured in Cult and the Occult. So that was a little tribute there, because this is one tarot spread, actually, that Kubrick would have definitely been aware of from reading that book.
All right. Cult and the Occult is one of the references we know of for Eyes Wide Shut, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I will put the links in the Farm. You had the Vice Up, right? So the Vice Up blog is still around, and then you have the Farm podcast, and what's your website? Tell me again their website.
I'll just go to the Farm, Google the Farm podcast Mach 2, and then obviously there's the Patreon and all this other good stuff as well.
So you got Patreon going, right? So you got Patreon, the whole blog, your podcast, and there's a website, another website out there. And Sean, do you promote your stuff, please?
You can find me at Wake the Dead. I've just done a new presentation regarding Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, where I play the film synchronized with itself at 1 hour intervals, and it is amazing. This is how the film should be seen. It's like a cipher. It's like a key to open the door to the rest of this, what this film it really is. And I put that on Odyssey and Rumble. Look up Fidelio Experiment, and you will all be very much amazed. Also, I did a presentation about 3 years ago called Occult Kubrick and the Butterfly Net, and you can find that on Odyssey, BitChute, and Rumble. And my podcast is Wake the Dead. Yes, we've done work.
We did 4 hours of this, so you can see that on... Hopefully it's still on YouTube. You can definitely see it on Rockfin. But Sean has done a lot of work on Eyes Wide Shut. You can check out your podcast is Wake the Dead too, right?
So that's right. Yes. And you can find me at onegreatworknetwork.com /Sean-McCann.
And the book we discussed today is titled The Minotaur, A Kubrick Odyssey, and the author is S. William Snyder, just published. People, check it out. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Let's do this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Transform your home in one weekend with paint from Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.